This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So, welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Michael Siciliano about creative control, the ambivalence of work in the culture industries. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
This is a great book. It's really, really interesting. It speaks to lots of important debates that are going on in cultural studies, in sociology, in particular fields like the study of cultural and creative industries, but also as I was reading it, it kind of struck me that the book is basically a story of like what work is like now and, you know, what it's like to do particular jobs, particularly jobs that people seemingly think are kind of like, you know, to use actually one of the key terms that comes up in the book, you know, jobs that people think are really kind of cool. And I suppose the place to start is I guess a question about like, why were you interested in studying, what we'd call kind of like creative labor? Like what's sort of different and special about these creative jobs?
Sure. I mean, at a very kind of high level, over the last, 30 or 40 years, there's been a lot of talk, from economists, from sociologists, from all sorts of different kinds of scholars and public policymakers about the importance of, what Robert Reich called, symbolic analysts, what Richard Florida called the creative class. These people are thought of as kind of like the motors of the economy or the people who will, are really central to not just work, but just, producing value for global economic activity or whatever, and there's that, right? And I think the project kind of stems off of that broader kind of interest that people have in that. But I think for me, something I was kind of interested in that is more like theoretical is that like when we talk about a creative work or creative workers as being central to the economy, it struck me as quite different than the way we used to think about, or many people still do think about, like creativity as being somehow resistant to capitalism or resistant to power. And I'm thinking about you know, the work in like cultural studies in the 70s, like Stuart Hall and Dick Heptage and Paul Willis and Angela McRobbie, who we were talking about just a few minutes before we started recording, and you know, about how people kind of like reinterpret mass culture, reinterpret capitalist produced commodities, and that that's kind of an act of, you know, resistance at the level of meaning making. And it struck me as that today, actually, the economy or the workplace kind of invites that very same kind of activity. And so for me, I was just, you know, it's kind of like, well, what does that really do to how we understand the role of being creative under sort of capitalism, if that makes sense?
And interestingly, the book, I suppose, it doesn't do this exactly, but it kind of says there's like two positions on the rise of this, whether we call it like, you know, symbolic production or, you know, the kind of making of culture that is, you know, separate to or distinctive, resistant to overarching kind of capitalist production. And that's that on the one hand, the people doing this stuff kind of like, you know, just capitalist cogs in the machine, and they don't kind of get, you know, how they're being exploited and alienated. And I suppose that comes through actually in the contemporary cultural studies literature. And then on the other hand, and you mentioned Richard Florida, who I guess is one of the great kind of advocates of this kind of particular, whether we call them like a new class or like a subclass or you know, subsector of the economy, whereby like everything these people do is like awesome, and it, you know, raises local tax revenues, and they have like total kind of autonomy, and you know, like they're like a new what was the book subtitle? It's like, you know, how they're reshaping the world of work or something like this. And I suppose you're trying to say, look, it's kind of a bit more complicated than that. And I suppose this comes with how you theorize kind of what creativity is and what it is to be kind of creative in work. You know, there's a bit of kind of autonomy, but also there are definitely kind of constraints.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, on one hand, people are kind of given a long leash and are kind of invited to, you know, be creative. And that can mean a lot of different things. And I can talk about that in a second. But on one hand, there's this kind of what I call in the book, this kind of like managerial invitation, this kind of, you know, and you see this in a lot of different forms of work. It's not just like work in the culture industries, but lots of forms of kind of tech work or other kinds of jobs. I mean, even like call centers, you see this today. Research and call centers where people are kind of invited to be themselves, to express themselves, but they are invited to do so in very particular ways. And that's something I get at, I think it's like in the second chapter of the book, which is you know, kind of trying to say, well, there's different discourses of creativity that operate at work. And so, you know, when managers say they want creative workers, they want this kind of like instrumentally kind of pragmatic creativity, where it's about solving kind of like ready-made organizational problems, and kind of people improvising their way towards solutions to those problems. Whereas, you know, workers will talk about, or at least the ones that I spoke with for the book, will talk about kind of, you know, something akin to, you know, romantic ideas of artistry or something like that, which is a very different kind of a way of understanding of what it means to be creative at work. And then something else I kind of deal with is like the effect of platforms on creative work. And, you know, platforms, or in the book, it's YouTube, invites another kind of creativity, which is this sort of quantified, other-oriented kind of entrepreneurialism, where it's about kind of achieving metrics. And so, you know, how people achieve these various ends of creativity is kind of up to them, or is left up to them, either by management or by the platform. But it's always kind of oriented towards particular either organizational goals or the whatever the platform's kind of goals are, which is usually about increasing, you know, audience size. So yeah, people, it's like this, there's this kind of freedom within a very bounded space, or it kind of reminds me of a kind of older, that's like a punk song, but it's also a kind of situationist track, right? Which is like this kind of like bigger cages with longer chains. That's always kind of something that has been in the back of my mind with when thinking about how these people work.
It's good you mentioned the kind of traditional view of artistic creativity, and then, you know, you bring in things like YouTube, the platform economy, because that's the heart of the book, is the comparison between sort of, dare I say it, a kind of a traditional mode of cultural work in the music industry and in a studio, and then you know, this kind of new and emerging mode of cultural work, and you've got these two organizations you look at, Sonico and The Future, and before we start to kind of unpack, you know, what's going on with both of them, how they're similar, how they're different, I wonder if you could just say like a little bit about them, you know, maybe just in terms of kind of what they do. Like Sonico, you know, I think people will be fairly kind of familiar with what like a recording studio is and what it does. But The Future as, you know, a kind of platform economy content producer, if that's even the right word, listeners might kind of be sort of less familiar with this this new kind of cultural work and cultural industry.
Yeah, I mean, so for me, you can think of both of these as kind of cultural intermediaries of a sort. A recording studio, yeah, it's a fairly conventional kind of organization. Basically, musicians or production companies will hire out the studio or rent the studio to record music, right? And it, you know, it looks like the things that people might see in movies or television shows, where there's like the, you know, the room where the musicians set up, and then there's the person behind the, you know, console with all the knobs and things like that, and they set up microphones and they record music. And there's some things that are a little idiosyncratic about Sonico, in that it's also a rehearsal studio, but there's actually kind of like a lot of those in LA and places like Nashville and New York, where it's kind of this multi-use facility. But yeah, it's a recording studio, where music's made, and it's kind of a mid-level studio. So you get like a range of different kinds of people coming in, from like teenage ska bands to like Grammy award winners, right? And you get everything in between. The Future, which is kind of a, you know, the name is a little bit tongue in cheek, because it's, you know, a lot of people in the social media space like to say, oh, we're the future of media. The Future is what some people are calling kind of like a social media intermediary organization. And in particular, it's what they call a multi-channel YouTube network, or MCN. And these have kind of stopped being quite as important in the YouTube space, as they call it. But basically, they're akin to sort of like a one part talent management agency, one part, you know, music or film distributor. They mediate between the platform and people who create content, or what is sometimes called content creators, which is includes influencers, but is more expansive than that. But basically what these social media intermediaries do, like The Future, is they kind of sign people to management contracts. They perform some degree of kind of client services for people who make social media content. And in exchange, they receive a percentage of the content creator's profits, whatever they get from either ad revenue or from like brand deals and things like that.
The sort of similarities and differences are pretty, you know, kind of clear, even to begin with, even though, you know, we might say they're both, you know, kind of providing a service or whatever, but things like, you know, revenue models are different. The way they go about sort of dealing with clients and all this kind of stuff. And I wonder, and this might be a slight kind of misreading of the book, but it struck me that you had perhaps more, if not sympathy, but, you know, there was a certain engagement with Sonoco around the kind of workers' practices and their, you know, kind of working lives, and maybe a bit more kind of caution, you know, if still, you know, sort of empathetic engagement with the workers in the future. And maybe we'll deal with kind of both of them in turn as the book does. So it'd be good to hear a bit about the sense of the kind of like working life. And I think you used the term, the kind of social regime, in the recording studio in Sonoco, particularly the kind of positives and negatives, you know, the kind of sense of sort of engagement, craft, you know, that kind of sense of being involved in aesthetic production, but at the same time, you know, pretty low pay and some, you know, quite kind of alienating, or, you know, some distance from the products, if we might call them that, that the studio was producing.
Right. You want me to talk about that a little bit, or?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Sorry. I wasn't sure where you're going with that. Okay.
I suppose I've given quite a sort of summary of of what you would do with maybe you could add like, you know, a little bit of kind of color and flavor from the ethnography.
Yeah. So the recording studio, I mean, I think you're right in highlighting that there is kind of like a difference in feel between how I deal with Sonoco and how I deal with the future. And I think and part of that, I think that highlights the role of an ethnographer's kind of subjectivity when they're interacting with people. And also it has to do a little bit, I think, with the nature of the access that I had. So, but yeah, let's start with life at Sonoco. I mean, like, it's a recording studio, and the music industry or just culture industries in general, but music in particular and music recording even more specifically is very gendered. It's very kind of, there's a very strong kind of like masculine work culture, and a lot of kind of, you know, people making off-color jokes and geeking out about music equipment, and kind of, you know, talking about where to get the cheapest taco that still tastes good, and things like that. And a lot of kind of, I don't know, a lot of almost kind of like a reminiscent of like, you know, ethnographies of kind of like more blue collar workplaces, where there's a lot of kind of like joking and gentle ribbing among the people that work there. So there's this social element. There's also an intensely technological element where people are constantly talking about just these, you know, kind of immersive moments had in relation to different kinds of music technologies. So like synthesizers are talked about a lot in the book, but also recording consoles and just this kind of being enamored with different pieces of equipment that are owned by the studio. And it kind of makes this like pleasing experience of being at work alongside all of this kind of dense social relationships that people have, different kinds of jokes that people, you know, play on each other, and things like that. And actually part of, so that's what's kind of going on there. And actually like part of the labor that they perform, in addition to like, you know, coming up with new ways of running the studio or new ways of, you know, selling musicians on, you know, instrument cables in between sessions or whatever, part of their value as labor, part of their labor's value is their ability to kind of generate social ties between the studio and its clients, or generate kind of a good reputation for the studio. Like, oh, those are the people who, you know, can kind of creatively improvise when things go wrong in the studio, that and kind of develop a good reputation. And to me, those are like kind of classically social in a way, right? They're about like relationships between people and other people, or the organization and its potential clients. And so that's why I kind of call it like a social regime of labor, because like the value of creative labor in that context is kind of hinges on the ability for people to kind of generate these kind of very social relationships, reputation, or relationships between clients or something like that. Whereas like the future is much more of a kind of like corporate workplace in a way. I realize that that's kind of a vague term, but you know, it looks, the inside of it, these kind of aesthetics of the workplace are very much like one might expect from like more of a tech sector company, like the sort of stereotype of the tech sector with the open offices and everything is kind of rearrangeable. No one really has a fixed workspace. In a way, they kind of feel, you know, homeless at work. There's actually something I describe, but something that's described in the book. There's also this like moment where like, you know, the managers or the human resource people kind of put up a photo booth so that people can like take photos. You know, it's supposed to be like a fun workplace or something like that. And actually what ends up happening is the people who are laid off or fired, which there are a lot, turnover was really high there, end up taking pictures of themselves on their last day and putting them on a wall. And one of the employees refers to that as like the wall of the fallen. And I think, so like, to go back to kind of your question, like, I think their difference in the rendering, the ethnographic kind of rendering of these two spaces is that like at Sonoco, you know, the people there were some new employees that came and went, but during the several years that I was on and off doing fieldwork there were like the same batch of guys working there. And I say that specifically because it was pretty much all men there. And so like, you know, you can really develop relationships with people or just really get a sense for how they are. And you develop a bit of comfort with them as well. Over the course of several years, you know, and whereas at the future, turnover was quite high. There were people in executive positions that, like, when I left the field, would say, "Hey, you outlasted me." you know, where like the ethnographer is in the business or is in the workplace longer than the employees are. And so in that space, it's really hard, I think, for the ethnographer to really kind of develop the same kind of relationships with people. And also I think that says something about the work experience for the employees, is that they're very much, everything is very tentative. Everything is very precarious, and much, much, maybe much more so than, you know, other more conventional, culture industries, which are already, you know, well known for being kind of, the site of like precarious employment. And, you know, I think it's something I try to do in the book is to try to link that kind of heightened kind of precarity to it being a platformized industry.
I mean, the other thing you talked several times there about, I guess, what we might call the kind of the gender politics of the recording studio. And you know, this is all well known, the kind of gender politics of the music industry. But, you know, one thing that struck me about the future was, and again, you know, we there's always the risk of, you know, kind of fetishizing or, you know, having a kind of a fantasy vision of these, I don't know, artisanal forms of cultural production, like a recording studio where, you know, people are, as you say, talking about, you know, the kind of quality you get from a particular recording deck or, you know, whatever, like, you know, the kind of the acoustics of a space, this kind of stuff. Whereas the future is, you know, this kind of quantified place, you know, where things are much more, you know, kind of measured and made visible. But there was something, I suppose, uniquely depressing about the future's claims to be kind of, you know, participatory, open, the idea that anyone can be a creator, you know, that there's the kind of opportunity for a democratization of culture, which, you know, is absolutely not the case in the recording studio. And, you know, the book picks up a couple of times on things like, you know, skill and craft and, you know, this kind of stuff. But actually, and you mentioned, you know, kind of outlasting some of the senior staff. At the future, there were still all the problems of kind of inequality, particularly around kind of, you know, men, white men running stuff. But there seemed to be a kind of a very different story, not to justify that, but you know, basically to almost kind of like paper over those cracks and not to talk about it. So it'd be interesting to hear a bit about, I suppose, the kind of like inequalities in Sonico and inequalities in the future and why they kind of persist in their different ways.
Yeah, sure. So let's start with the future because it's kind of complicated, right? And, you know, so yeah, the future is it's just operating in this kind of like, you know, social media industry or social media space, as they might say. And I think they're, you know, despite headway that's been made by a number of scholars to point out the opposite of this, there's still kind of a widespread belief that, as you said, anyone can produce content. There's sort of platforms level the playing field. And I think what we're seeing in a number of, you know, great books that have come out recently is that's not the case at the level of the platform, wherein, you know, algorithms and other things like the calculation of metrics have race and class and gender and issues around sexuality kind of like built in to the way that those technological systems function. But something I tried to point out is that in the book is that in addition to that, there's still there's still hierarchies within various, you know, organizations, the future being one of them, that are still, you know, have, you know, white, mostly, you know, mostly white kind of men at the top. And even in a company like The Future, which was quite diverse inside the organization in terms of sexuality, in terms of gender, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of race, the leadership was still like white men. And you could actually see this, I mean, quite literally, like at like board meetings, like women did not have a seat at the table, right? They'd be like quite, they'd be like along the outer ring of seats. And then there would be the, you know, main table that pretty much universally men sat at. And I say this having like taken, you know, head counts at every staff meeting I went to. So as a result of that, you get, you know, you get a situation in which people can produce whatever they want on YouTube, but a lot of opportunities for, say, like brand partnerships or the pitching of particular creators to, say, movie studios or something like that, you know, for work in film or whatever, which is something that companies like The Future do, typically went to content that I think most people would find at best would find it highly problematic, and at worst just completely disgustingly racist. So there's that going on. So I think like part of what's important to me is the highlight is that like despite this kind of like opening up of the potential for lots of different kinds of people to produce content, there are still these very in a way conventional hierarchies that contribute to the reproduction of a variety of different kinds of inequality, whether that's along lines of gender or race or sexuality. It kind of reproduces all of those, which is, I think, a little different than what happens at, I think, Sonico, which is that you have this very, it's like you have a very kind of, like there were women that work there. But I got the sense that they ended up leaving just because of the kind of broiness of the workplace, but not necessarily because they weren't allowed to be there. Whereas at the other place, they were kind of allowed to be in the organization, but only in very kind of specific places. So something I talk about in the book is that, like, you know, most of the women that would come in there would be kind of shunted into working on, say, like beauty vloggers or something like that. And that was like a frequent complaint of people that I worked with while I was doing field work. So even in this sort of social media space, there is kind of this like reproduction of like hierarchies that, you know, reproduce inequality along various lines. Whereas I think in the conventional space, you still get that for sure. But it can look quite different.
It's tricky balance, you know. And again, you know, I keep coming back to this impression I got from the book of, you know, you wanting to say like there are loads of problems with cultural work in the recording studio. You know, low pay. There are like loads of issues with it. But in some ways, you know, the kind of literally the future really isn't, you know, kind of delivering on the promises around the kind of the digital or the kind of tech-led cultural and creative economy. And it strikes me as a kind of like concluding question. What do we sort of do about this? You know, is there any way to, you know, to kind of take, I suppose, the kind of, you know, the social world of the recording studio and have that be the model for the content management space like the future? Is it just, you know, if you're going to be working in a kind of quantified content production intermediary, you're going to have to get used to the idea that, you know, your job security won't be there. You know, there will be like lots of kind of annoying downsides and you'll probably, you know, jump to another job, or I say probably, or hopefully, because, you know, a couple of the key interviewees ended up kind of out of work and not able to re-enter jobs, particularly kind of straightforwardly. And yeah, I guess there is this kind of question of like, you know, should we be resisting the power of platform? Should we be learning lessons from the kind of older forms of cultural work? You know, should we be saying all cultural work is really bad and we need to like defend bureaucratic modes of like unionized blue and white collar jobs that don't have any of this creativity nonsense associated with it?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And it's one I'm not so sure I have the answers to at the moment, which is, I think, why I kind of conclude with this like opening question, like, what do you do with these situations? And I think for me, you know, something I've been thinking about a lot is that like a lot of what these jobs seem to be missing, and I think you're right to pick up So on one hand, the quantified kind of regime of, you know, the future in the book, but quite literally, like, the future of work is one that is, like, missing a lot of social components, even if it's just the social interaction of your manager telling you what to do, right? A lot of that work, and you're seeing this in studies of, you know, there's the book Ghost Work, but also studies of other platforms where people are managed by, you know, algorithmic management. I mean, it's not, you know, or they're managed by metrics and things like that. Like, there's a book, Metrics at Work, that came out recently too. And that it is kind of removing, you know, a sort of social component. So maybe there is something to be learned from more conventional modes of creative work. But I also think, like, you know, this is something touched on in the conclusion of the book, is that, like, a lot of what is going on here is that people aren't paid enough to kind of reproduce themselves. And so they have to engage in a lot of different kinds of jobs in addition to whatever may be their main job. And then on top of that, they're constantly being invited to be creative, to use their judgment. And yet that judgment, that creativity, is always subordinate to someone else's goals. And so you have this curious situation in which people are continuously, like, being asked to be creative, to use their judgment, and they get to do so in very particular ways, many of which they don't agree with, and so they feel alienated. They're using their skill, their capacity to make decisions in the service of someone else, and on top of that, they're not paid enough to reproduce those skills, that creativity, that judgment, that creative labor that they're using for the job, right? And so they have to kind of engage in this kind of chasing after work all over the place in order to reproduce themselves. And so, you know, I think it puts you, yeah, it puts people in a very difficult situation in the sense that they do kind of gain some enjoyment, some pleasure from the job. There's kind of an intense dissatisfaction or intense kind of feelings of alienation. And so it's, you know, it's unclear. It's kind of ambivalent is the way I describe it. It's an ambivalent situation in which it's like something that might compel you to kind of resist or push back or exit. Kind of is in tension with things that are actually quite compelling or quite interesting or quite dynamic. So what the future of work should look like, I think, for me, or what we need to think about, is how is it that we could have something that resembles, I don't know if I'd say full-on bureaucratic kind of mode of organizing work, but something that regulates work in a more meaningful way than just saying, like, okay, well, you're free to be an entrepreneur of yourself. But something that is also just as kind of aesthetically or affectively engaging as a lot of different kinds of creative work can be, right? And I think that in some way that's kind of a problem of labor politics, is that, like, well, you're confronted with, you know, workplaces in which you have a dozen computer screens blinking at you and cell phones kind of vibrating against your pocket or in your pocket and sights and sounds that are kind of, like, engaging, even if they're, you know, maybe make people uncomfortable. They're certainly, like, engaging, right? And people talk about that actually quite positively in some of the interviews in the book. You know, it's the best video game ever when I'm looking at my data analytics, or, oh, I just spent the afternoon, you know, merged with the, you know, music equipment or whatever. And when you're confronted with, like, a working day that is, yeah, kind of alienating, that is kind of precarious, but is also dynamic and, like, engaging. And then you go to, you know, some sort of, like, stuffy meeting in which, you know, people are wanting to sing old union songs from the early 20th century or something like that. It's just like not as compelling, I think. So something I kind of conclude on, and I don't know if this is a clear-cut answer to your question, but is that, you know, any kind of like politics of work in the 21st century or in the, you know, 2021 or whatever, needs to be, you know, engaging at an aesthetic or kind of affective level in order to be kind of compelling for work, and also needs to revolve around this issue of judgment, which I brought up a few minutes ago. And I think to that end, at least to the issue of judgment, you're already kind of seeing that in various kind of creative or culture sectors. You're already kind of seeing that with Google, for example, right? There's a lot of discussion around ethics, and people are kind of, you know, pushing back. I want control over the ethical aspects of my, what I would say, my creative labor or knowledge work or whatever. And you're already kind of seeing some of that, you know, bear out. So, you know, in some ways, I think to go back to your question, like what lessons can we learn? I mean, I think that these absences, these things that are either denied or kind of like left out of these creative labor processes are the potential, you know, fault lines or line or fractures along which that labor might be organized. And so for me, it's both about this sort of affective or kind of aesthetic engagement, or what I call in the book, aesthetic enrollment, right? And then also this sort of like politics that revolves around judgment or which you are actually kind of, we're starting to see, at least in the tech sector. We'll see what happens in the culture sector, but.
All that ambivalence that you talk about sounds like the perfect kind of setting for more research, another book, another set of projects. So what are you going to be kind of working on next? Or are you, you know, kind of thinking about something completely different? You know, you've had quite enough of awesome, really cool record studios and like literally seeing the future of work. And are you going to do something completely different?
Right now I have a couple projects in various stages of development. So one is something I'm working on with like a colleague that is more about like how it is quite different. It's about how people with disabilities navigate like online dating platforms. And so that's still very much about platforms. But another project that it's kind of in the very beginning stages of development, but kind of builds on this stuff, is really thinking about like what place means in the digital economy, and how place maybe relates to how people imagine platforms offering them a future. So one thing that, you know, I kind of got a little bit of in the research for the book, but just a slight inkling, is that, you know, where people are really shapes the way that they think of platforms as offering an opportunity. So, you know, for example, you talk to, you know, people making YouTube content in Los Angeles, and they imagine the platform is giving them a sort of future by offering them a future by, you know, future pathway to Hollywood. Whereas some of the folks that I met in the Midwestern United States, or what I would call the Rust Belt, which is like where I'm from originally, you know, deindustrialized parts of the country, a lot of them kind of imagine the platform as kind of offering just an alternative to unemployment, which is quite a different way of Basically either I go work at a Walmart or something like that, or I can make YouTube content, which is a very different imagined future when compared to like, oh, if I make, YouTube content, I could be a Hollywood star or something like that. I'm kind of thinking about what that means for, the future of work, what that means for how people are able to imagine a future amidst, kind of decaying industry or deindustrialization. And it seems also like, the fallout from the pandemic. How is it that people are able to imagine something resembling like a livable life or a life worth living in their view? And I guess that's something that kind of fascinates me and also seems like a really kind of pressing issue given the situation the world kind of finds itself in.